Hey guys, welcome to Fitness Mentor's presentation of the audio lectures for the NASEM Corrective Exercise Specialist Exam. We are here to go over Chapter 2 as we look towards page 7. And Chapter 2 is really going to be talking about human movement science. And when we think about human movement science, I really want you guys to understand that I expect a bit of previous knowledge to already be attained on this subject, so I'm not really going to get super detailed as we go through each of these pages because it is a long chapter, and I do want you guys to already have a decent understanding of this. So I'll point out what's most important to understanding corrective exercise, as well as what might be most important to passing this exam. So looking at page 7, as we start to talk about the human movement system, which consists of the nervous system, the muscular system, and the skeletal system, we really want to understand that the nervous system activates the muscular system to then pull on the skeletal system and create that sort of movement. We're going to kind of lead from there into understanding biomechanics, and biomechanics is basically going to use the principles of physics to understand how forces interact with the body. And that's kind of the definition that you do definitely need to know just in general for this sort of topic. So let's go ahead and flip over to page number 8. And when we look at figure 2.1 up in the top left-hand corner, the human movement system, as we know and as you should know already, is made up of the skeletal system, the nervous system, and the muscular system. And definitely understand how that works, which I already kind of mentioned. So now we're going to talk about anatomical terminology. And this is the stuff that hopefully in the field you got a good understanding of, to understand, you know, the planes of motion, the axes of motion, the joint motions that occur in each plane, and then looking towards the muscle actions, eccentric, concentric, isometric, and so on and so forth. So, talking about anatomical terminology, we're going to start by understanding what is the sagittal plane. So the sagittal plane is going to divide the body into right and left halves, and the motions occurring in the sagittal plane are going to be flexion and extension. Flexion and extension do occur at things like the spine, the elbows, the wrists, the knees, the hips, the hand. And really, when you think about flexion and extension, it's that sort of front to back motion, which is parallel to that sagittal plane. So yeah, walking, squatting, deadlifting, typically we'll say lifting your arm forward, just anything in that front to back sort of motion is definitely going to be in that sagittal plane. So let's go ahead and look over to page 9 when they look at figure 2.2 in the planes of motion. You have an anterior posterior axis, a coronal axis, and then the longitudinal axis. Remember, the sagittal plane is associated with the coronal axis, also known as the frontal axis or medial lateral axis. And as when looking towards this test, you do kind of need to understand a little bit about that, but they're really going to be more focusing on the basic exercises that really control, fixing postural imbalances and things of that nature. So having a good understanding of this is still definitely beneficial. But looking to page 10, as we look at the joint motions occurring in the sagittal plane, I want you to have these memorized. You should have these memorized already, but sagittal plane, remember, any flexion, any extension, specifically on this page, of the shoulder, of the hip, of the spine, even, you know, all areas of the spine, lumbar spine, thoracic spine, cervical spine, elbow, or the elbow definitely, as well as dorsiflexion, plantar flexion of that ankle. Those are really the sagittal plane motions. Any flexion or any extension is going to be in the frontal or the sagittal plane. Keep that in mind about the medial lateral axis, what NASEM calls the coronal axis. So looking at table 2.1 on page 11, and really talking about the sagittal plane, what motions occur in the sagittal plane, we talked about that. That's flexion and extension. What axis? NASEM wants you to know it as the coronal axis. And examples, hopefully you already have a good idea of this, but, you know, walking, running, maybe some, tricep extensions, that squatting, lunging, things of that nature, calf raises, and so on. Beyond that, as we're going to talk about this as well, but we'll just kind of go over the chart while it's here, page 11, frontal plane, what motions occur. We do want you to know what joint motions occur. That is abduction, adduction, any lateral flexion. Typically, that's going to be at the spine, and then eversion and inversion, which is at the ankle. The axis associated with the frontal plane is that anterior-posterior axis. And remember, guys, the axis is perpendicular to the plane. Okay, perpendicular means at a T. or goes directly through it. And then the transverse plane motions are going to be any rotation. And also, you can think of, well, yeah, pronation, supination, internal and external rotation, right and left spinal rotation, things like that. But then also horizontal adduction and horizontal abduction. That's like giving someone a bear hug or a chest fly or a bench press. When you think of that sort of horizontal plane, that is also about the longitudinal axis or the vertical axis, and a rotation is occurring there. Examples are cable rotations, any swinging of any piece of sporting equipment, things of that nature. Spinning like a ballerina would or an ice skater would, that sort of thing. All right, so frontal plane, once again, divides the body into front and back halves or anterior posterior halves and goes about the anterior posterior axis. Here, the anterior posterior axis runs basically straight through the shoulder in a front to back way so that the abduction and adduction can occur at that shoulder joint. Yeah, we talked about the joint motions are occurring, but yes, abduction, adduction, lateral flexion, inversion, eversion are really going to be the main one that you need to understand. So flipping the page to page number 12, as we look at some of the joint motions that occur in the frontal plane. Yes, you have your shoulder abduction and adduction. You have your hip abduction, adduction, lateral flexion, which they actually don't show here, and then inversion and eversion. Okay. Then looking at the transverse plane, that does divide the body into top and bottom halves or superior and inferior halves. And some of the longitudinal axis is the axis associated with the transverse plane. And then, yeah, cable rotations, any rotation, spinal rotation, as you look to page 13, some of those images. You have shoulder internal rotation, external rotation, hip internal rotation, external rotation, pronation, supination, spinal rotation are going to be what they're really want you to understand. But then we're going to get into combined joint motions because most movement doesn't just occur in one plane. You know, a throwing motion really has multiple planes occurring at once in different joints. But really, whenever we think about human movement, you want to isolate the joint that you're thinking of to try to explain it. Because in a bench press exercise, during the concentric portion, yes, you have elbow extension. But most people associate a bench press with working the pectoralis major, and that is crossing the shoulder joint. So you have to isolate each joint when talking about, we'll say, specific exercises and analyzing their kinesiology or the kinetic movement. So combined joint motions, really you're focusing on how the body works together. And really, the body does work in multiple planes of motion at all times. The example they give is going to be gait or walking, and how walking you have rotation of the hips, of the femur sometimes. Also, you know, kind of pushing off by that plantar flexion. And really, I do want you guys to memorize and look at table 2.2 under functional biomechanics at the bottom of page 14. And I do want you to have this memorized because what happens during pronation of the foot, or just pronation in general is what they're going to talk about, and then supination. So, and the reason why you have to understand this is because during the gait, you do have pronation and supination occurring, as well as if the body does have, we'll say, one side that's pronated or one side that's supinated, it can affect the entire mechanics and movement and joint positioning of the entire body. So, looking at foot pronation, or what they deem pronation of the body in a way, which doesn't really make too much sense, but foot pronation causes this dorsiflex, everted, and adducted sort of foot and ankle. Okay, the knee then slightly flexes, adducts, heads inward, and internally rotates. And the hip does the same as well. So you have sort of this internal rotation of the femur, knee at the knee and the hip, and really that adduction in which the knees kind of point inward. We'll talk about lower extremity pronation and how that's associated with pronation distortion syndrome, which you may remember from your CPT studies in future pages, but that's really going to be kind of what you're looking at. The main thing is that pronation occurs more frequently and is a muscular imbalance, we'll call it, typically, and does affect the entire kinetic chain. How does it affect the entire kinetic chain? Right there in table 2.2. I want you to memorize that. During supination, the foot is going to do the exact opposite that it did during pronation. So foot and ankle are going to plantar flex, invert, and adduct. And that's kind of like, you can imagine the knees kind of bowing outwards and the foot kind of coming off. That's really going to be what happens. Femur externally rotates, knees are pointing outward a little bit. Doesn't happen too commonly and shouldn't, it shouldn't be looked at as a postural imbalance too much. Maybe with the knees go outward, that sort of thing, you can see that. But I don't even think NASM has a very specific way to address that sort of motion, except for when knees turn out and you kind of work on that muscular imbalance. But at the knee and the hip, you have extension of the knee, abduction, the knee going outward, and external rotation, the knees and kind of pointing outward. So looking at figure 2.6, you're kind of seeing what pronation looks like and supination looks like. The right picture on the top there, top right picture on page 15, is actually a neutral stance, not necessarily pronation, but the arrows are showing what it should kind of look like. But you can see the skeleton being really affected on pronation, and notice the knees have that gap at the medial side of the knee. You'll see that larger gap in the joint, and that can really cause some issues on the MCL, on the cushioning, on the lateral meniscus, things like that. So yeah, that's kind of good there. Let's look at figure 2.7 as we look at supination and pronation during gait. Yes, in the contact, you kind of have that supination occurring. Mid-stance, it kind of goes to neutral. And then propulsion is that pronation or kind of pushing off that toe side as you look at it. But nothing too important there. Page 16, as we look at figure 2.8, the effects of pronation on the entire kinetic chain. So what you're seeing here is, if you notice, the anatomical left of this person has the internally rotated or pronated foot, therefore knee, therefore hip, and notice how it drops the hip on the left side, causing those angles to be, or those lines to be not parallel. So basically you can notice if one side of the body does have pronation, whether that be from, you know, sitting one certain way your whole life or having tight muscles on one side, it really does affect the entire kinetic chain and can cause some major issues and pain throughout that person's body. All right. So now looking at page 17 under muscle actions, we're going to get into the major muscle actions, which are going to be eccentric, isometric, and concentric. I expect you guys to have a previous understanding of what those terms are. Active is always producing force. It's just a matter of if that force is being produced eccentrically, isometrically, or concentrically. So eccentric refers to the muscle developing tension while lengthening. Okay. The way that I like to describe this to all of my students is really that the object or free weight, when something is a free weight, it is lowering or going with gravity, getting closer to the floor. If it is a free weight and it's moving closer to the floor, you can guarantee that it is eccentric. That's a good way to look at it. Also known as a negative. Isometric is going to be the muscle resisting force, but no change in muscle length is occurring. So it's just a hold. An isometric hold means the muscle is contracted and active, but there is no change in force. All right, and then you can kind of look at the getting your facts straight, page 17, the gravity and its effect on movement. Obviously, gravity always is pushing down on us. This typically creates or increases the eccentric demand by our muscles, and therefore eccentric training is just as important. If anything, even more important from an injury prevention and athletic standpoint, because, you know, it is easy to accelerate safely, but then decelerating safely, eccentrically, is something that needs to be practiced to prevent injury. Most injury does occur during deceleration compared to acceleration. Like cutting and changing directions would be considered deceleration. So the muscle action spectrum, table 2.3, obviously memorize this. Hopefully you already have it memorized, not too crazy of a deal. But the reason why you might need to understand this is because on this test, NASM will start to talk in ways that you need to understand, like what muscle concentrically accelerates a specific joint motion. So for instance, what muscle concentrically horizontally adducts the shoulder joint? Okay, holy crap, that was a whole bunch that I threw out there at you. But that's the type of language that you're going to need to understand to pass this test. Okay, so just to analyze that, what muscle? So they're looking for a muscle that concentrically accelerates or concentrically moves horizontal adduction of the shoulder. So horizontal adduction, you need to know what that is, which is basically the upward portion of a bench press. And what muscle performs that? That is going to be the pectoralis major. But then they might even ask, what muscle eccentrically decelerates shoulder horizontal abduction? And it's the exact same muscle, which is the pectoralis major. So I know I'm getting scaring you a little bit there. I can make that a little easier in another example, which I'll do right now. So what muscle concentrically accelerates elbow flexion? So you think of elbow flexion, what muscle concentrically does that? So you can think of the bicep curling, elbow flexion, and the muscle is going to be the bicep. Okay, but then at the same time, the bicep also eccentrically decelerates elbow extension. Okay, so to explain that, the elbow is extending, but it's slowly extending because it's eccentrically decelerating. Okay, so we'll get into that more as we get further through this book, but that's the real reason why you need to understand muscle actions for this particular certification or for this specialization in corrective exercise training. All right, so let's flip over to page 19 and just kind of finish up with concentric. Hopefully you guys know what concentric is, but it is the muscle is shortening, producing force to shorten against gravity. It's considered a positive. The upward motion against gravity on any free weight is going to be concentric, that sort of thing. And then muscular force, they just kind of quickly mentioned as we start to get into some of the, we'll say principles and relationships, but force is basically going to, any force is going to result in an acceleration or deceleration of an object. Okay, so when something is applied or when force is applied, acceleration or deceleration typically occurs. That sort of thing. But it's basically the interaction between two entities that results in a change of acceleration or deceleration. So the human movement system is all about producing force because we need to interact with our environment and to survive. So let's first talk about a length-tension relationship as we move over to page 19. Length-tension relationship refers to basically the how at a certain length of the muscle, which is typically resting length, the muscle produces the most force. And that therefore there is an optimal length of force production for every muscle. That's typically around resting length of that muscle. And the reason is due to this myosin and actin overlap between the sarcomere, and basically you have the, and it will show you in the picture on the next page, but you really have this ability of your contractile proteins within the muscle. When they're fully stretched, there isn't as much cross-bridging able to happen. Also, when it's fully contracted, there's no further movement that can occur. So there's really this optimal length in which the most force can be produced, and that's the optimal length-tension relationship, which is going to be typically the resting length of the muscle. And that's, it can produce the most force at that. Okay, so let's go ahead and move over towards the next page as we kind of talk about length-tension relationships a little further, page number 20. And I want to look at, before we get into force-velocity curve, I want to look at the length-tension relationships, middle of page 20. And we kind of talk about this sarcomere and how it has a completely contracted state and then a lengthened state. What you'll notice is that the myosin is going to be the myosin heads are going to be the red bars, while the actin filaments are going to be the black sort of grid-looking bars. And when the myosin and actin attach is when force can be produced. What happens at the resting length is that there's optimal overlap of the myosin and actin filaments, therefore the most attachments, therefore the most force can be produced. When a muscle is completely contracted, there's zero force because it cannot go or contract any further. When the muscle is completely stretched, there is no overlap occurring, therefore it can't produce as much force. The example here would be something like trying to do a bicep curl with a really heavy weight, completely extended arm. There's not as much force that's going to be produced in a right-angled elbow. And the reason, or one thing that you may see in the gym, as an example, would be that a person that does pull-ups only in a limited range of motion near that 90 degrees of elbow flexion, because it's the easiest, and that because that's where the most overlap occurs, that's the strongest point. Someone can knock out 20 pull-ups if you're only going above and below 90 degrees by, you know, 30, 40 degrees, compared to a completely straight elbow and doing a pull-up, which is much harder. So, in my opinion, always work towards that full range of motion, obviously unless there's pain present. But yeah, full range of motion is going to be important with all exercises. So to continue with the force-velocity curve, and specifically force-couple relationships, force-velocity curve, you just have to understand in a sense that if there is a lot of force that needs to be produced, typically the velocity is going to be lower. If there is a tiny bit of force that needs to be produced, the velocity is going to be higher. The example here is doing a 5-pound dumbbell bicep curl, which can be done very, very fast, compared to a 50-pound dumbbell bicep curl, which is going to occur much slower, due to the fact that when force is high, velocity is typically low, and inverse, which is that inverse relationship. That's kind of what you need to understand for that force-velocity curve, force-velocity relationship. Next, we're going to talk about the force-couple relationships, and basically how in the force-couple, what you really need to understand is that many muscles work together to produce movement. So it's not like isolated movements for every exercise that you do. There's not too much isolation that really occurs in the body during normal human movement. What a force-couple relationship refers to is that, the example they give on page 21 is the upper trapezius, middle trapezius, and lower trapezius and serratus anterior working together to produce upward rotation of the scapula. So it's kind of this many muscles producing force in different ways that assist with that movement. Pretty much every single motion in the body is not done by one muscle, it's done by a group of muscles. So that force-couple relationship describes how muscles work together to produce effective movement. So, also, if one muscle is tight in a force-couple relationship, you will have an issue with that entire muscle group properly producing the correct movement. So keep that in mind. And that's kind of what they're going to get into from the scientific standpoint of why you need to work with corrective exercise with your clients. So as we get into the middle of page 21 and they start to talk about muscle leverage and arthrokinematics, arthrokinematics is basically just another word for joint movement, but really just the science of kind of understanding how the joints move. But muscle leverage is going to be important because almost all movements in the body occur through a lever system, in which you have this pulling with a fulcrum and a force and a resistance that allows for that human movement. So really with a muscle leverage system, you just need to understand the three different classes of levers, first class lever, second class lever, third class lever, which we're going to go over on the next page and I can give you examples on. But before we do that, let's talk about how levers work in the sense of the rotary motion and torque. Rotary motion is going to be the movement of the bones around joints. Rotary motion just refers to more or less rotation, but it's a way to describe that rotational motion. And torque is going to be any force that produces a rotational movement. So really the way that muscles force is measured, because pretty much all muscles produce a rotational force, is in torque. So muscles produce this torque to create human movement. It's kind of just the way that they want you to understand it. But flipping over to page 22, we'll first go over the levers, which is at the bottom, figure 2.14. But I want you to understand the three types of lever systems. They may ask you this on the exam, and I want you to really understand what they are. So figure 2.14, page 22, bottom. We're looking at the left one first, which is going to be that first class lever. A first class lever is basically a seesaw. You have a effort or force being applied on one end. That effort is the force. So let's say someone's sitting on the left side of the seesaw. The fulcrum is in the middle, or the axis you can call it, and then the resistance is what needs to be lifted upwards. It's the other person on the other side of the seesaw. So the example of a first class lever in the human body is the skull sitting on the cervical spine and going in that seesaw sort of motion. Okay, so the neck, I want you to know, is the main first class lever that NASM would ever test you on. The second class lever, and this one is the one I definitely want you to know, is going to be the more or less the calf muscle contracting to produce people say plantar flexion. Okay, and what's different here is notice that the fulcrum is moved to the completely left side, or where the ball of the foot would be in this image. And the resistance is going to be the lower leg or the tibia. And then the effort or the force being produced is the calf muscle pulling upwards or shortening in that sense. And second class levers are really known for being able to lift extremely heavy weight as the resistance is in the middle. So it decreases the length of the lever, in which therefore decreases the force that needs to be applied to move that object or to move the resistance. Okay. And then third class lever, this is most of the levers in the human body. This is going to be the elbow joint is their main example. Knee joint is very similar. But you have a fulcrum on one side, but the effort or the effort, which is the force, is going to be in the middle, and then the resistance is going to be all the way out towards the hand or furthest away from the fulcrum. And what that does is it's really good for promoting the speed of the resistance. So let's say that that person is holding a ball in his hand and he wants to throw that object fast. That long lever is going to allow for that object to be moved very fast. It's not going to lift extremely heavy weight, but it is good for throwing things. And that's why we were successful as in our hunter-gatherer days at hunting by throwing objects to eat, we'll say. Cool. So that is going to be the lever systems, and you need to know the examples of where they are in the body. Knowing the effort, fulcrum, and resistance isn't, 100% necessary, I'd say. Maybe just from a personal training standpoint, it is okay, but I almost never brought that up with any of my clients. So, but understanding where they are in the body is definitely important for tenacity. And then when we look at efficient human movement on page 22, figure 2.13, they kind of talk about what efficient human movement is, what optimal human movement is, that really they describe it as neuromuscular control, this optimal neuromuscular control. And the way that it works is going to be that a normal length tension relationship leads to normal force couple relationships, therefore normal joint arthrokinematics. What normal force couple relationships is optimal sensory motor integration, optimal neuromuscular efficiency, and optimal tissue recovery. So basically, in order to continue this process, you need to have a normal length of each muscle, meaning the muscles cannot be tight. If the muscles are tight, it throws off optimal neuromuscular control and does not work towards efficient human movement or normal joint arthrokinematics because they are altered. So we're going to take a break before we move into that middle of page 23 in functional anatomy. We're going to take a quick break, and I will look forward to seeing you in the second presentation for chapter 2.